This weekend starts right after this.
It's October, and what does that mean? Well, it's Geico-ween, of course. Don't be spooked by high rates on car insurance. Geico is brewing up spellbinding savings that they're crafting just for you. See how much you could save. Get a quote today at geico.com.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Battling for child care. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Parents and child care providers are still struggling as the coronavirus pandemic rolls into its eighth month. Hear how they're coping.
On the personal finance front, a list of irrational ways we make decisions that can mess up our retirement savings.
At first, we were distracted by lawnmowers and dogs as we began working from home, but October has brought a new nuisance.
And the man known as the NFL's biggest cheapskate.
Some people like to laugh at me, but I definitely was extremely cheap starting out throughout my years in college and continued that now. Just being very cheap and trying to be very smart, as smart as I can through my saving techniques and everything like that. Just really, you know, not spending a lot of money on a lot of things and just really being really disciplined.
A conversation with Miami Dolphins lineman Christian Wilkins on finances and what he eats to maintain his 6'4", 315-pound body. Well, before the coronavirus pandemic hit in March, there were nearly 12 million children under the age of 5 enrolled in some type of child care nationwide. The pandemic, however, forced about half of providers to shut down at some point during the last 7 months and has left 1 in 5 child care employees, about 214,000 of them, out of work as of August. A couple of their stories from Megan Lenhart, senior reporter at CNBC Make It. Megan, what are we seeing?
We're still seeing both parents and providers really hanging on by a thread. You would think, you know, we're so many months in that we would have seen some more recovery, but it turns out that child care providers still operating on, you know, very, very high operational costs, and then parents being still very afraid to send their children back, and so enrollment really has not returned to pre-pandemic levels as of yet.
Right. Explain the story of that woman you talked to in North Carolina who runs her own daycare center. She's just about emptied her savings account trying to make things as safe as possible from COVID, and still her enrollment's way down.
Yes. So this piece was actually part of a series called The COVID Economy that we're doing, and we're looking at North Carolina. So I actually interviewed Cassandra Brooks, who was amazingly generous with her time and her story in trusting it to me, but she actually runs Little Believers Academy just outside of Raleigh, North Carolina, and there are two locations, and she is actually incredibly concerned that she's not going to be able to make payroll this month. And you have to imagine, as a small business owner, that is probably the worst feeling in the world. She knows that these employees are relying on her. She knows that parents are relying on her, and yet she can't seem to make the math work. In fact, she's actually been operating at a loss for several months now, as you know, these grants that she's been getting, PPP loans, it's not like she hasn't had some support, but it's just not enough.
She got two centers. Did you say one's at about 40% capacity, the other one 50? Was that her?
Yes, that is. It's crazy, right? I think it just should be a little bit higher at this point, especially because so many parents are actually back at work, even part-time in the office, and you do have schools reopening at this point, and you know, several of them in the area are actually reopening for in-person learning as early as this month and then almost full-time in November. So it's kind of interesting. It's all coming a little bit at an intersection right now where we have these child care providers who have been really hanging on these last couple of months. They, you know, certainly have been providing care for the essential workers. Many, though, had to close even partially. And then now you have people like Cassandra who are actually going through positive COVID cases happening at the child care center. And, of course, that's very, very scary for everyone involved. I mean, certainly parents, I imagine, are incredibly nervous. But you also have the staff and the teachers and Cassandra herself who are sitting there, and they are on the front line of this.
We're speaking with Megan Lenhart, senior reporter at CNBC Make It. Her piece is called Parents and Child Care Providers Are Still Struggling as the Pandemic Drags On. What are parents saying about this, about maybe why they're not sending their kids to these child care centers?
So I think parents are also, you know, definitely weighing some heavy decisions here. And I actually spoke with one, Jessica, who was very upfront, and she said that her father actually passed away from COVID, and it completely changed how the family looked and felt about the virus and the pandemic at large. She and her husband actually have no plans to send their children back in person to school or daycare until there's some kind of viable vaccine. And a lot of parents are in that same boat. But then there's other parents who, quite frankly, have to work and they just can't do their jobs remotely anymore. They absolutely have to have childcare. And so they are sitting there and trying to find the best possible solutions for their families and trying to make it work. And of course, you know, they're still coming up short sometimes. I was talking with Sarah Caldwell, again, another new resident, and she was talking about how there was just no way that they were going to be able to continue to have both her and her husband work and have the children at home and care for them while still trying to do their job. So it's really a little bit of, you know, everyone trying to figure out the best solution that works for their family.
On a slightly different angle, too, in your story, Dan, I understand that some of these childcare or daycare centers are actually opening up space for like in a WeWork environment where kids can actually are not enrolled at the center, but actually come in and use the space to do schoolwork.
Yes. So actually, it's really interesting. During the course of my reporting around childcare and education right now, Bright Horizons actually rolled out programs through its own centers and partnerships, and many major employers have actually signed on to this program where they offer supervision and support to students who work remotely right now. And I love Sarah's description of it. She really nailed it. She did say it sort of felt like a little mini WeWork for kindergartners, which is both a funny analogy, but also a little sad description on what the reality is right now.
Thanks, Megan. Megan Lenhart, senior reporter at CNBC Make It. Coming up next, Miami Dolphins defensive end Christian Wilkins on food and finances. Do business more powerfully during Dell's semi-annual sale. Save up to 45% on Dell computers and servers with Intel Core processors. Also, save on electronics and accessories, plus free shipping on everything and special financing with Dell Business Credit. Call 877-ASK-DELL to talk to a Dell Technologies advisor who can help you find just the right tech. That's 877-ASK-DELL or visit dell.com/businessdeals.
When it comes to mobility, Michigan is making what the rest of the world hasn't even thought of yet. Our state is home to two world-class autonomous vehicle testing sites, and we're first in the U.S. for mobility-related patents. With over 500 miles of roadway equipped for connected vehicle testing, it's no wonder that everyone is moving to where it all started. So if you're ready to move into the future with your mobility business, see how we can help at planetm.com/pure-opportunity.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's a blended story of sports and personal finance. Christian Wilkins, defensive end for the Miami Dolphins, is known as the NFL's biggest saver when it comes to his personal finances. He won a national championship with Clemson, but may have been more well-known for being a substitute teacher while in college and saving $15,000. He's teamed up with Capital One's Journey student credit card on a number of new initiatives. Christian, how long have you had that reputation?
Some people like to laugh at me, but I definitely was extremely cheap starting out throughout my years in college and continue that now, just being very cheap and trying to be very smart, as smart as I can through my saving techniques and everything like that, just really, you know, not spending a lot of money on a lot of things and just really being really disciplined. And so, you know, that's really how that I kind of got that reputation.
Is that something you learned from family? Where'd that come from?
Well, I don't know. I just always been like, I don't know. I just kind of, like, I just always, as a young kid, heard the stories about NFL players going broke or just about people not being financially secure and things like that. And I just knew that I didn't want that to be me. Whether I made it to the NFL or whether I, you know, worked a 9-to-5, I just knew I wanted to be someone who was going to be able to get the most out of life and be able to be financially secure.
So when it comes to money, you said you were cheap, you know, starting in even in high school and college, but you know, you make millions now. Do you allow yourself a little fun money? What do you do?
It's a balance. Everything in moderation is, you know, is always good. And like I said, it's just discipline. Like the way I save, I allow me to have a little bit of fun, but I always make sure I pay myself first and put my money in places where I need to know that it's going to grow or that I'm going to save. And then whatever I have left over, you know, from there, which is a lot smaller of a percentage, you know, I allow that to build. And once it builds, I could do a little bit more here and there, allow myself to have a little bit more fun and do a little bit of things. But even then, I'm still a pretty much a very low-key guy and don't need a lot to be fun. I'm perfectly content with going on a trip somewhere, or I'm perfectly content with just staying home and just hanging out and doing nothing by myself. So,
what do you drive when you're 6'4", 315 pounds? You got a truck?
Yeah, I got to have a truck. Yeah. I grew up in the north, but I went to school down south in South Carolina. So a truck is definitely my one thing I picked up on the school. I got me a nice Chevy that I drive.
Nice. Do you have locker room conversations, by the way, with some of your teammates about money? Any of them ever corner you and say, "Hey, Christian, I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about that. Help me out."
Yeah, definitely. You know, a lot of my teammates come to me for advice. I go to a lot of my teammates for advice. And, you know, it's interesting to definitely hear from a lot of guys who are in similar situations to you and kind of hear about their plans or what they're doing, things they're investing in, how they're managing and saving their money, and just kind of bounce ideas around. NFL locker room has some of the not only the most, like, talented individuals athletically, but also some very high intellectual people of high intellect, you know, who just lived a lot of life and experienced a lot and seen a lot of things. So it's always good to kind of just bounce ideas off each other and talk about a lot of different things.
So you led me into one of the things I was going to ask you, and that is, what do you eat? Because obviously you've got to maintain a big frame for the position you play. So what do you do? How do you keep that weight on? Because obviously you're burning tons of calories during the week.
Well, an easier question would be, what don't I eat? You know, I kind of eat a little bit. There's a shorter list of things I don't eat, but it's really got to be eat, you know, a lot of protein, get my carbs, veggies, whatever it is that's just going to keep me going and being able to, you know, carry on a heavy workload.
All right, so you don't skip meals, I presume?
Not at all, no.
So what's a typical breakfast like? Are you a multi-egg guy? What's that dish look like?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure. I definitely start off with like a 4 or 5 egg omelet, maybe a couple pancakes, fruit. And then my omelet's pretty loaded as well with meat, veggies, and things like that. And then a smoothie or something like that as well.
Holy cow. All right, so, well, I can't stop now. Transition to lunch. What's that lunch look like?
lunch is usually, for me, it's usually after practice. So, again, you know, I have a lot of protein, have, like, some salmon or a big piece of chicken with, you know, side of veggies and side of, you know, potatoes or something like that. And then for dinner, it's pretty similar as well.
Thanks, Christian. Christian Wilkins, defensive end for the Miami Dolphins, teaming up with Capital One's Journey student credit card. Coming up next, the latest annoyance for those working from home. Chances are you're spending too many hours of your day and fees out of your pocket doing business banking the old-fashioned way. It's 2020. There's got to be a better, more affordable solution. There is. It's Aslo, a free business checking account with invoicing, bill pay, money transfers, no minimum balance, no fees, and no minimum deposit. And now there's the all-new Aslo Pro Bundle with unlimited envelopes to organize your money, discounted instant transfers, and the ability to set up recurring invoices, all for just $10 a month. But because you're listening to this podcast, you can try Aslo Pro free for 14 days at aslo.com/deal. Learn more with a free copy of Aslo's Small Business Starter Guide, or get started right now with an Aslo Pro free 14-day trial at aslo.com/deal. There's no minimum deposit required. Get started for free at aslo.com/deal. That's AZLO.com. Aslo is owned by BBVA USA, member FDIC. aslo.com/deal. Millions of American workers last spring thought the silver lining of quarantine would at least be exchanging the hustle and bustle of the office for the relative peace and quiet of home. Then yard work season began. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
First, it was lawnmowers and barking dogs. Now it's leaf blowers. As Valerie Borline of the Wall Street Journal tells us, the tools are the latest seasonal hazard for people who are working from home. Valerie, why have leaf blowers become such a big problem?
Well, a couple of things, Jennifer. I think we've gone from 2.5% of us working at home full-time before the pandemic, right? 2.5%. Now it's 34%. And that was it was as high as 40% of American workers being home full-time at the height of the lockdowns. So I think what's happening is people are home and they're much more aware of the noise around them, particularly leaf blowers, which in certain parts of the country, kind of their use peaks in the summer when you're cutting your yard. But in much of the country, leaf blower use peaks in the fall. And when the leaves are falling, which is, you know, mid-October to mid-November. So we're just seeing this spike in noise complaints over the kind of wah-wah leaf blower noise.
Are there different leaf blowers that are more quiet than other ones?
You know, leaf blowers are kind of inherently noisy. And the most common ones are these little two-stroke motors, gasoline engines, that are really pretty loud. I mean, louder in decibel levels, louder than a school cafeteria if it's outside your room, which is pretty noisy. So there are electric leaf blowers. They're a little bit more expensive. It's not entirely clear that how much quieter they are, but they certainly emit less air pollution and potentially less noise pollution.
Valerie, do we think that they are being used properly or overused or used for things they shouldn't be used for?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. There have been some really creative uses of leaf blowers. I think they're in heavy use, you could say for sure. Because we've seen a real spike in people doing yard work. People are home. They're investing in, you know, nesting and fixing up their homes. So we certainly have seen a spike in their use.
Do landscapers like to use them?
You know, they say, look, it's a necessary evil. It would be cost prohibitive to rake a yard. It would be, the consumer would be paying double or triple what they're paying just for the hours of labor. They're saying that, you know, we talked to a National Association of Landscape Professionals, and they say, we'd love to get to electric. We will over time, but it's expensive, and it's going to take some time to roll all that out.
We're speaking with Valerie Borline of the Wall Street Journal. Valerie, if you're one of the people working inside and you can't really close your windows, or you can close them and you still hear the sound, are there other things you can do to muffle it?
Well, you know what they say in journalism, you got to write what you know. And guess what? I schedule certain interviews on days when I know the neighbor's yard guys aren't around. There are things you can do. I talked to a big time Democratic fundraiser who's raised, you know, $35 million in support of Joe Biden in the past 5 months. He has, when the noise starts up outside his window, he heads to different parts of the house to try to avoid it, and has ended up in the bottom of a walk-in closet, for example. You know, I talked to a musician who spends a lot of her time composing, and she puts on her, you know, her studio headphones just to try to drown out the noise, even if nothing's playing over them. So there's strategies, but it's a pretty pervasive noise. I should say there's a couple reasons for that that I didn't know until we reported out the story. But you know, like when you're at a stoplight in the car next to you, you can hear the, you know, kind of the thump of the bass of that from the music. These certain sounds have these low frequencies and long wavelengths, meaning they can pass easily through walls and windows, much more so than other sounds. And leaf blowers in that category. And it also is not, you know, a regular kind of solid droning on sound like maybe a lawnmower. It's an up and down sound as you kind of, you know, rev the engine. So I think there's two reasons why leaf blowers are particularly difficult to tune out.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Valerie Borline. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. If you're looking for a special gift for someone this holiday season, something truly unique,
I've got a great idea. An original hand-painted portrait from paintyourlife.com. At paintyourlife.com, you can send any photo or combination of photos, and a world-class artist will transform them into a beautiful portrait at a truly affordable price. I recently had a portrait of our kids done. It's incredible. Now hangs prominently above the fireplace in our den. Taking less than 5 minutes, the order process was a breeze, and our painting arrived in about 3 weeks, packed and handled as if it were the most delicate item ever shipped. At paintyourlife.com, there's no risk. If you don't love the final painting, your money is refunded. And right now, as a limited time offer, get 20% off your painting. That's right, 20% off and free shipping. To get this special offer, text the word DEAL to 64,000. That's DEAL to 64,000. Paint your life. Celebrate the moments that matter most. Text DEAL to 64,000 for paintyourlife.com. Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, the best productivity practices during COVID. Also, irrational investment decisions that can mess up your retirement plans. Plus, how next-door neighbors with opposing political views have stayed the closest of friends. And 2020's best wine counties outside of California. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. This portion of the program is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. There are ways companies and schools can not only adjust to the new normal, but actually thrive. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, founder of the Enderle Group, as a look at best productivity practices during the pandemic. Rob, like what?
Companies that were aggressive with digital transformation and had put in place methods to deal with employees in mass, were highly automated, had developed and deployed AI architectures, which is kind of automating the machines, were able to flip to work at home relatively quickly because everything was automated, and so the administrators could be pretty much any place and the employees could be pretty much any place. And on top of that, because we discovered a whole bunch of employee interaction issues when you start moving people remotely. You know, some people are self-motivated, some people aren't, some people need a lot of people around them, some people work fine without it. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, is for those companies that had HR organizations that weren't just compliance organizations that were focused on the care and feeding the employees and already started to instrument the employees, also seemed to do better. They advanced that instrumentation, implemented programs where there were regular weekly meetings between senior staff and the rest of the employees, and changed the way that managers and employees interacted, both in terms of frequency and methods, and kind of created these distributed families of people that, for some screwy reason, are actually working better now than they worked on premise. A number of the companies are now reporting significant increases in sales, productivity, and efficiency with people working at home because those folks are not wasting time in long commutes, not struggling with, okay, I've got to be home for dinner. You're right. Already home. And while they do have distractions at work, those at homework now that they didn't have before, they don't have the distractions they had at work when they came into the office. And so those two things have seemed to balance and wipe each other out. So the net impact on those firms that have an aggressive HR department and were already fairly well automated have been very positive.
How about on the schools front, Rob?
Well, so schools were a bit different. The schools are differentiated by the fact that they tend to be understaffed, underfunded, and so a lot of schools really struggled with this switch. Those that did best, however, were those that already had a large remote student body, either due to illness or disability or whatever. They'd already put in place the mechanisms to deal with those students. And schools were very aggressive with regard to virtualization. They tended to deploy virtualized desktops as opposed to shipping out individual pieces of hardware or trying to support the students' hardware already in the field. And, you know, I already said they were understaffed, so trying to deal with that level of complexity kind of sunk a lot of schools. But for those that had deployed virtual instances of desktops, those instances just run on whatever the students have, and those students then can go to whatever vendor they bought the hardware from for technical support. So that allowed the teachers to go back to teaching and not be technical support themselves, which has also been a big problem for a lot of schools, and get the students and the materials as a priority, so that stuff just simply worked, and the teachers could go on with being teachers.
We're speaking with Rob Enderle. He's the principal and founder of the Enderle Group. He's written a piece for computerworld.com called Best Productivity Practices During the Pandemic. What else has stood out here for you?
Well, I just how well we've kind of adopted to this. I'm actually on, as we're doing this, I'm attending Dell Technology World, and they're talking about the next steps with regard to where we're going to go, particularly with education and blending AR, augmented reality, VR, virtual reality, and doing classes that are now worldwide as opposed to regional, with things like automatic translations going on behind the scenes, so you get classrooms that can span languages, that can span countries, and can cover interesting topics all around the world, and the students don't have to travel to the class. They're safer. They get a better education, and they're much more engaged. They're able to do things and interact with things that might have otherwise required them to fly to some other part of the globe. And, of course, most students can't afford either the time or the money to do that. So being able to do all that stuff virtually is probably going to change our future quite a bit. And this is all accelerated where we were already going with regard to the application of technology significantly.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm called the Enderle Group. Coming up next, irrational investment behaviors. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. On the investment front, it's hard to say if now is one of those calms before the storm, but at the least, it's a period of relative calm after the coronavirus-induced stock market plunge in February and March and the robust rally that followed, of course. And that makes it a decent time to assess how you might have messed up your investments by selling hastily or taking other irrational actions. Russ Wiles, personal finance columnist at the Arizona Republic, has a look at some irrational investment behaviors. Russ, give an example.
One would be focusing on recent events, this recency bias. You know, the market drops 300 points and you think that it will continue, whereas, there could be no relevance going ahead. We tend to overweight the last day or few days when making decisions. And that can be a problem if we're not keeping things, in proper perspective.
How do you do that with something like recency bias, for example?
Well, one suggestion they had was make it as part of your investment plan to have like a timeout period where, you have like a 3-day period before you take any action. And I can discuss that in a bit further, but, kind of a timeout, so to speak. But it's not easy.
Yeah.
These are emotions.
Right. Number two, you said blindly following along.
Well, that's the herd behavior. And, in our past as humans, safety in numbers often was a good idea. Mm-hmm. But when you're dealing with wild market gyrations, it isn't always right because the herd, other investors could be wrong too, and it happens. So I think you just have to try and think for yourself. I mean, we like safety in numbers, but it can get us into trouble at times.
We're speaking with Russ Wiles, personal finance columnist at the Arizona Republic, part of the USA Today network. He's written a piece about irrational ways to make investment decisions. Another one he talked about was trading through overconfidence. How does that work?
Well, that's kind of the reverse. I mean, we've been talking about the market drop earlier this year, and at times like that, I don't think most people were overconfident. But in general, overconfidence bias leads us to believe that we're better than most other people. And there have been other studies in this realm. For example, Morningstar cited a research that indicated we tend to think we're better than other people driving, for example. They cited a study where 90% of the motorists considered themselves above average drivers. Right. That can't be true, So we tend to be a little bit more overconfident sometimes, kind of making rash decisions without really fully thinking it through, weighing the consequences. And as research has shown, men tend to be worse in this in the investment field than women.
What about seeking out validation? Point number five.
Well, that's cognitive dissonance. We're more susceptible to opening ourselves up to information that confirms that we made the right choice. If you sold GM yesterday, you want to look for news articles that indicate GM is in trouble. It's just, it's an emotional, we want some sort of assurance that we did the right thing. Nothing, I guess, wrong with that, except that it kind of closes us off to a more balanced perspective, more realistic perspective.
Thanks, Russ. Russ Wiles, personal finance columnist at the Arizona Republic. Coming up next, how politically opposite neighbors have remained close friends. Today, I'm here with Josh Hunt, Executive Vice President and Chief Business Development Officer at MEDC, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Josh, what are Michigan's best selling points?
The biggest selling point for Michigan is our pure Michigan quality of life. We also have a diverse and abundant workforce and a business-friendly environment that we think is unmatched. It's also very connected to global supply chain assets. And through a comprehensive suite of programs and services, we can help businesses grow here in this state and also help provide access to our highly skilled workforce, where we have the highest concentration of engineers and some of the greatest skilled trades talent as well. Here in Michigan, we make things, and we think we can be the convergence of technology and manufacturing, and there is no better place to bring your idea or product from concept to reality than here in Michigan.
To hear more of this interview with Josh Hunt from MEDC, go to thismorningwithgordondeal.com and click on the MEDC microphone. Well, people on opposite ends of the political spectrum can actually like each other and be civil. That may be news to some folks. Claire Ansberry, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, has a look at 3, 2, 1. Well, people on opposite ends of the political spectrum can actually like each other and be civil. That may be news to some folks. Claire Ansberry, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, has a look at two families in a suburb of Pittsburgh who've become role models of sorts for the rest of the country. Claire, what's this about?
These people have been living next door for 14 years. They've always known that one was far right and one was far left, but their kids went to school together, they played hockey together, and they really considered themselves more neighbors than somebody who was a Democrat and Republican. So they put up their signs, and it's really never been too much of an issue, but this year things are so heated that, signs were being stolen, people were being uncivil, and they decided that they had enough, and they wanted to set an example to their kids, so they made handmade signs saying, "We love them," with arrows pointing to the other house. The message being, we can get along, we don't agree, but we can get along.
They're not trying to browbeat each other into believing the other side's position. That sounds like part of the win-win here.
Right. I mean, one woman said, "Look, we have no desire, we're under no illusion that we're going to change each other. But we accept that. We can listen to each other. We're not going to argue. Certain subjects they avoid because they're a little too divisive. Abortion is one. They have discussed it and they listen and then they let it go."
What's the reaction to the story been like?
It's been positive. Most readers have said they really welcome a message like that. Some of them say, they want to be like that, and they're looking for ways because they sense polarization in their own families and friends. One woman said that she would cringe whenever she saw a sign in a neighbor's yard endorsing the other candidate. And she said she thought less of that neighbor, and she said she was going to try to do better.
We're speaking with Claire Ansberry, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She's got a touching story that's entitled "How Next Door Neighbors with Opposing Political Views Stayed Friends." And one of the ways they did that was that they kept their Biden and Trump signs up, but they have signs pointing at each other's lawns that say, "We love them." So what was the advice from these families? Because I know that resonated too.
Sure. One was simply treat others the way you want to be treated. Another was except that you don't have to be right. One of the men in the story said, I always thought I had to be right all the time growing up. He said, if you don't think you have to be right, you listen more. Somebody else said, recognize that the other person deserves respect and be willing to consider their opinion. And don't be so quick to judge someone because of the political sign in their yard.
Thanks, Claire. Claire Ansberry, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, the best wine regions outside of California. Do business more powerfully during Dell's semi-annual sale. Save up to 45% on Dell computers and servers with Intel Core processors. Also, save on electronics and accessories, plus free shipping on everything and special financing with Dell Business Credit. Call 877-ASK-DELL to talk to a Dell Technologies advisor who can help you find just the right tech. That's 877-ASK-DELL or visit dell.com/businessdeals. Well, finally, when you think of wine counties, wine tours, even award-winning wines, do you think of regions of Oregon, Washington State, Texas, or Arizona? Well, Lawn Starter is out with analysis ranking 2020's best wine counties outside California. That means some of the best wineries to visit are often much closer to home. Lawn Starter measured 18 categories, including visitor accommodations like hotels, motels, and inns, the number of winery tours, the number of wine producers, tasting options, the number of vineyards, and the number of award-winning wines. According to those metrics, the best wine counties outside California are number one, Benton County, Washington, number two, King County, Washington, Clackamas County, Oregon was third, followed by Yavapai County, Arizona, and Travis County, Texas, rounding out the top five. Next on the list, Jackson County, Oregon, Loudoun County, Virginia. Then it's Yamhill County, Oregon, Washington County, Oregon, and number 10, Suffolk County, New York. So only two counties on the East Coast make the top 10. Everything else is west of the Mississippi. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Want to know what's really scary? Seeing just how much you could have been saving on car insurance by switching to Geico. It's almost as scary as watching your dog growl at the wall and realize he sees something you don't. Get a quote at geico.com.